Now Jonas's group had taken a new place in the auditorium, trading with the new 11s, so that they sat in the very front, immediately before the stage. They were arranged by their original numbers, the numbers they had been given at birth. The numbers were rarely used after the naming, but each child knew his number, of course. Sometimes parents used them in irritation at a child's misbehavior, indicating that mischief made one unworthy of a name. Jonas always chuckled when he heard a parent, exasperated, call sharply to a whining toddler, "That's enough, 23!" Jonas was 19. He had been the 19th new child born his year. It had meant that at his naming, he had been already standing and bright-eyed, soon to walk and talk. It had given him a slight advantage the first year or two, a little more maturity than many of his groupmates who had been born in the later months of that year. But it evened out, as it always did, by 3. After 3, the children progressed at much the same level, though by their first number one could always tell who was a few months older than others in the group. Technically, Jonas's full number was 1119, since there were other 19s, of course, in each age group. And today, now that the new 11s had been advanced this morning, there were 2 1119s. At the midday break, he had exchanged smiles with the new one, a shy female named Harriet. But the duplication was only for these few hours. Very soon he would not be an 11, but a 12, and age would no longer matter. He would be an adult like his parents, though a new one and untrained still. Asher was 4, and sat now in the row ahead of Jonas. He would receive his assignment 4th. Fiona, 18, was on his left. On his other side sat 20, a male named Pierre, whom Jonas didn't like much. Pierre was very serious, not much fun, and a worrier, and tattletale, too. "Have you checked the rules, Jonas?" Pierre was always whispering solemnly. "I'm not sure that's within the rules." Usually it was some foolish thing that no one cared about, opening his tunic if it was a day with a breeze, taking a brief try on a friend's bicycle just to experience the different feel of it. The initial speech at the ceremony of 12 was made by the chief elder, the leader of the community who was elected every 10 years. The speech was much the same each year, recollection of the time of childhood and the period of preparation, the coming responsibilities of adult life, the profound importance of assignment, the seriousness of training to come. Then the chief elder moved ahead in her speech. "This is the time," she began, looking directly at them, "when we acknowledge differences. You 11s have spent all your years till now learning to fit in, to standardize your behavior, to curb any impulse that might set you apart from the group. But today, we honor your differences. They have determined your futures." She began to describe this year's group and its variety of personalities, though she singled no one out by name. She mentioned that there was one who had singular skills at caretaking, another who loved new children, one with unusual scientific aptitude, and a 4th for whom physical labor was an obvious pleasure. Jonas shifted in his seat, trying to recognize each reference as one of his groupmates. The caretaking skills were no doubt those of Fiona, on his left. He remembered noticing the tenderness with which she had bathed the old. Probably the one with scientific aptitude was Benjamin, the male who had devised new, important equipment for the rehabilitation center. He heard nothing that he recognized as himself, Jonas. Finally, the chief elder paid tribute to the hard work of her committee, which had performed the observation so meticulously all year. The committee of elders stood and was acknowledged by applause. Jonas noticed Asher yawn slightly, covering his mouth politely with his hand. Then, at last, the chief elder called number 1 to the stage, and the assignments began. Each announcement was lengthy, accompanied by a speech directed at the new 12. Jonas tried to pay attention as one, smiling happily, received her assignment as fish hatchery attendant, along with words of praise for her childhood spent doing many volunteer hours there, and her obvious interest in the important process of providing nourishment for the community. Number 1, her name was Madeline, returned, finally, amidst applause, to her seat, wearing the new badge that designated her fish hatchery attendant. Jonas was certainly glad that that assignment was taken. He wouldn't have wanted it. But he gave Madeline a smile of congratulation. When 2, a female named Inger, received her assignment as birth mother, Jonas remembered that his mother had called it a job without honor. But he thought that the committee had chosen well. Inga was a nice girl, though somewhat lazy, and her body was strong. She would enjoy the 3 years of being pampered that would follow her brief training. She would give birth easily and well, and the task of labor that would follow would use her strength, keep her healthy, impose self-discipline. Inga was smiling when she resumed her seat. Birth mother was an important job, if lacking in prestige. Jonas noticed that Asher looked nervous. He kept turning his head and glancing back at Jonas until the group leader had to give him a silent chastisement, a motion to sit still and face forward. 3, Isaac, was given an assignment as instructor of sixes, which obviously pleased him and was well deserved. Now there were 3 assignments gone, none of them ones that Jonas would have liked. Not that he could have been a birth mother anyway, he realized with amusement. He tried to sort through the list in his mind, the possible assignments that remained. But there were so many he gave it up. And anyway, now it was Asher's turn. He paid strict attention as his friend went to the stage and stood self-consciously beside the chief elder. "All of us in the community know and enjoy Asher," the chief elder began. Asher grinned and scratched one leg with the other foot. The audience chuckled softly. "When the committee began to consider Asher's assignment," she went on, "there were some possibilities that were immediately discarded, some that would clearly not have been right for Asher. For example," she said, smiling, "we did not consider for an instant designating Asher an instructor of threes." The audience howled with laughter. Asher laughed, too, looking sheepish but pleased at the special attention. The instructor of threes were in charge of the acquisition of correct language. "In fact," the chief elder continued, chuckling a little herself, "we even gave a little thought to some retroactive chastisement for the one who had been Asher's instructor of threes so long ago. At the meeting where Asher was discussed, we retold many of the stories that we all remembered from his days of language acquisition. Especially," she said, chuckling, "the difference between snack and smack. Remember, Asher?" Asher nodded ruefully, and the audience laughed aloud. Jonas did, too. He remembered, though he had been only a 3 at the time himself. The punishment used for small children was a regulated system of smacks with a discipline wand, a thin, flexible weapon that stung painfully when it was wielded. The child care specialists were trained very carefully in the discipline methods. A quick smack across the hands for a bit of minor misbehavior, 3 sharper smacks on the bare legs for a second offense. Poor Asher, who always talked too fast and mixed up words, even as a toddler. As a 3, eager for his juice and crackers at snack time, he one day said smack instead of snack as he stood waiting in line for the morning treat. Jonas remembered it clearly. He could still see little Asher wiggling with impatience in the line. He remembered the cheerful voice call out, "I want my smack!" The other 3s, including Jonas, had laughed nervously. "Snack," they corrected. "You meant snack, Asher." But the mistake had been made, and precision of language was one of the most important tasks of small children. Asher had asked for a smack. The discipline wand in the hand of the childcare worker whistled as it came down across Asher's hands. Asher whimpered, cringed, and corrected himself instantly. "Snack," he whispered. But the next morning he had done it again, and again the following week. He couldn't seem to stop, though for each lapse the discipline wand came again, escalating to a series of painful lashes that left marks on Asher's legs. Eventually, for a period of time, Asher stopped talking altogether when he was a 3. "For a while," the chief elder said, relating the story, "we had a silent Asher. But he learned." She turned to him with a smile. "When he began to talk again, it was with greater precision. And now his lapses are very few. His corrections and apologies are very prompt, and his good humor is unfailing." The audience murmured in agreement. Asher's cheerful disposition was well known throughout the community. "Asher?" She lifted her voice to make the official announcement. "We have given you the assignment of Assistant Director of Recreation." She clipped on his new badge as he stood beside her, beaming. Then he turned and left the stage as the audience cheered. When he had taken his seat again, the chief elder looked down at him and said the words that she had said now 4 times and would say to each new 12. Somehow, She gave it special meaning for each of them. Asher, she said, thank you for your childhood. The assignments continued, and Jonas watched and listened, relieved now by the wonderful assignment his best friend had been given. But he was more and more apprehensive as his own approached. Now the new 12s in the row ahead had all received their badges. They were fingering them as they sat, and Jonas knew that each one was thinking about the training that lay ahead. For some, one studious male had been selected as doctor, a female as engineer, and another for law and justice. It would be years of hard work and study. Others, like laborers and birth mothers, would have a much shorter training period. 18, Fiona, on his left, was called. Jonas knew she must be nervous, but Fiona was a calm female. She had been sitting quietly, serenely, throughout the ceremony. Even the applause, though enthusiastic, seemed serene when Fiona was given the important assignment of caretaker of the old. It was perfect for such a sensitive, gentle girl, and her smile was satisfied and pleased when she took her seat beside him again. Jonas prepared himself to walk to the stage when the applause ended, and the chief elder picked up the next folder and looked down to the group to call forward the next new 12. He was calm now that his turn had come. He took a deep breath and smoothed his hair with his hand. 20, he heard her voice say clearly. Pierre. She skipped me, Jonas thought, stunned. Had he heard wrong? No. There was a sudden hush in the crowd, and he knew that the entire community realized that the chief elder had moved from 18 to 20, leaving a gap. On his right, Pierre, with a startled look, rose from his seat and moved to the stage. A mistake. She made a mistake. But Jonas knew, even as he had the thought, that she hadn't. The chief elder made no mistakes, not at the ceremony of 12. He felt dizzy and couldn't focus his attention. He didn't hear what assignment Pierre received, and was only dimly aware of the applause as the boy returned wearing his new badge. Then, 21, 22, the numbers continued in order. Jonas sat dazed as they moved into the 30s and then the 40s, nearing the end. Each time, at each announcement, his heart jumped for a moment, and he thought wild thoughts. Perhaps now she would call his name. Could he have forgotten his own number? No, he had always been 19. He was sitting in the seat marked 19. But she had skipped him. He saw the others in his group glance at him, embarrassed, and then avert their eyes quickly. He saw a worried look on the face of his group leader. He hunched his shoulders and tried to make himself smaller in the seat. He wanted to disappear, to fade away, not to exist. He didn't dare to turn and find his parents in the crowd. He couldn't bear to see their faces darkened with shame. Jonas bowed his head and searched through his mind. What had he done wrong? The audience was clearly ill at ease. They applauded at the final assignment, but the applause was piecemeal, no longer a crescendo of united enthusiasm. There were murmurs of confusion. Jonas moved his hands together, clapping, but it was an automatic, meaningless gesture that he wasn't even aware of. His mind had shut out all of the earlier emotions, the anticipation, excitement, pride, and even the happy kinship with his friends. Now he felt only humiliation and terror. The chief elder waited until the uneasy applause subsided. Then she spoke again. I know, she said in her vibrant, gracious voice, that you are all concerned, that you feel I have made a mistake. She smiled. The community, relieved from its discomfort very slightly by her benign statement, seemed to breathe more easily. It was very silent. Jonas looked up. I have caused you anxiety, she said. I apologize to my community. Her voice flowed over the assembled crowd. We accept your apology, they all uttered together. Jonas, she said, looking down at him, I apologize to you in particular. I caused you anguish. I accept your apology, Jonas replied shakily. Please come to the stage now. Earlier that day, dressing in his own dwelling, he had practiced the kind of jaunty, self-assured walk that he hoped he could make to the stage when his turn came. All of that was forgotten now. He simply willed himself to stand, to move his feet that felt weighted and clumsy, to go forward, up the steps, and across the platform until he stood at her side. Reassuringly, she placed her arm across his tense shoulders. Jonas has not been assigned, she informed the crowd, and his heart sank. Then she went on. Jonas has been selected. He blinked. What did that mean? He felt a collective questioning stir from the audience. They too were puzzled. In a firm, commanding voice, she announced, Jonas has been selected to be our next receiver of memory. Then he heard the gasp, the sudden intake of breath, drawn sharply in astonishment by each of the seated citizens. He saw their faces, the eyes widened in awe, and still he did not understand. Such a selection is very, very rare, the chief elder told the audience. Our community has only one receiver. It is he who trains his successor. We have had our current receiver for a very long time, she went on. Jonas followed her eyes and saw that she was looking at one of the elders. The committee of elders was sitting together in a group, and the chief elder's eyes were now on one who sat in the midst, but seemed oddly separate from them. It was a man Jonas had never noticed before, a bearded man with pale eyes. He was watching Jonas intently. We failed in our last selection, the chief elder said solemnly. It was 10 years ago, when Jonas was just a toddler. I will not dwell on the experience because it causes us all terrible discomfort. Jonas didn't know what she was referring to, but he could sense the discomfort of the audience. They shifted uneasily in their seats. We have not been hasty this time, she continued. We could not afford another failure. Sometimes, she went on, speaking now in a lighter tone, relaxing the tension in the auditorium, we are not entirely certain about the assignments, even after the most painstaking observations. Sometimes we worry that the one assigned might not develop, through training, every attribute necessary. Elevens are still children, after all. What we observe is playfulness and patience, the requirements to become nurturer, could, with maturity, be revealed as simply foolishness and indolence. So we continue to observe during training and to modify behavior when necessary. But the receiver in training cannot be observed, cannot be modified. That is stated quite clearly in the rules. He is to be alone, apart, while he is prepared by the current receiver for the job which is the most honored in our community. Alone? Apart? Jonas listened with increasing unease. Therefore, the selection must be sound. It must be a unanimous choice of the committee. They can have no doubts, however fleeting, if, during the process, an elder reports a dream of uncertainty. That dream has the power to set a candidate aside instantly. Jonas was identified as a possible receiver many years ago. We have observed him meticulously. There were no dreams of uncertainty. He has shown all of the qualities that a receiver must have. With her hand still firmly on his shoulder, the chief elder listed the qualities. Intelligence, she said. We are all aware that Jonas has been a top student throughout his school days. Integrity, she said next. Jonas has, like all of us, committed minor transgressions. She smiled at him. We expect that. We hoped, also, that he would present himself promptly for chastisement, and he has always done so. Courage, she went on. Only one of us here today has ever undergone the rigorous training required of a receiver. He, of course, is the most important member of the committee, the current receiver. It was he who reminded us, again and again, of the courage required. Jonas, she said, turning to him, but speaking in a voice that the entire community could hear, the training required of you involves pain, physical pain. He felt fear flutter within him. You have never experienced that. Yes, you have scraped your knees in falls from your bicycle. Yes, you crushed your finger in a door last year. Jonas nodded, agreeing as he recalled the incident and its accompanying misery. But you will be faced now, she explained gently, with pain of a magnitude that none of us here can comprehend because it is beyond our experience. The receiver himself was not able to describe it, only to remind us that you would be faced with it, that you would need immense courage. We cannot prepare you for that. But we feel certain that you are brave, she said to him. He did not feel brave at all, not now. The fourth essential attribute, the chief elder said, is wisdom. Jonas has not yet acquired that. The acquisition of wisdom will come through his training. We are convinced that Jonas has the ability to acquire wisdom. That is what we looked for. Finally, the receiver must have one more quality, and it is one which I can only name but not describe. I do not understand it. You members of the community will not understand it either. Perhaps Jonas will, because the current receiver has told us that Jonas already has this quality. He calls it the capacity to see beyond. The chief elder looked at Jonas with a question in her eyes. The audience watched him too. They were silent. For a moment he froze, consumed with despair. He didn't have it, the whatever she had said. He didn't know what it was. Now was the moment when he would have to confess, to say, "No, I don't. I can't," and throw himself on their mercy, ask their forgiveness, to explain that he had been wrongly chosen, that he was not the right one at all. But when he looked out across the crowd, the sea of faces, the thing happened again. The thing that had happened with the apple. They changed. He blinked, and it was gone. His shoulders straightened slightly. Briefly, he felt a tiny sliver of sureness for the first time. She was still watching him. They all were. "I think it's true," he told the chief elder in the community. "I don't understand it yet. I don't know what it is. But sometimes I see something, and maybe it's beyond." She took her arm from his shoulders. "Jonas," she said, speaking not to him alone, but to the entire community of which he was a part, "you will be trained to be our next receiver of memory. We thank you for your childhood." Then she turned and left the stage, left him there alone, standing and facing the crowd, which began spontaneously the collective murmur of his name, "Jonas." It was a whisper at first, hushed, barely audible. "Jonas. Jonas." Then louder, faster. "Jonas. Jonas. Jonas." With the chant, Jonas knew. The community was accepting him and his new role, giving him life, the way they had given it to the new child, Caleb. His heart swelled with gratitude and pride. But at the same time, he was filled with fear. He did not know what his selection meant. He did not know what he was to become, or what would become of him. Now, for the first time in his 12 years of life, Jonas felt separate, different. He remembered what the chief elder had said, that his training would be alone and apart. But his training had not yet begun, and already, upon leaving the auditorium, he felt the apartness. Holding the folder she had given him, he made his way through the throng, looking for his family unit and for Asher. People moved aside for him. They watched him. He thought he could hear whispers. "Ash," he called, spotting his friend near the rows of bicycles. "Ride back with me?" "Sure," Asher smiled, his usual smile, friendly and familiar. But Jonas felt a moment of hesitation from his friend, an uncertainty. "Congratulations," Asher said.
You too, Jonas replied. It was really funny when she told about the smacks. You got more applause than almost anybody else.
The other new 12s clustered nearby, placing their folders carefully into the carrying containers on the backs of the bikes. In each dwelling tonight, they would be studying the instructions for the beginning of their training. Each night for years, the children had memorized the required lesson for school, often yawning with boredom. Tonight, they would all begin eagerly to memorize the rules for their adult assignments.
"Congratulations, Asher," someone called.
Then that hesitation again.
"You too, Jonas."
Asher and Jonas responded with congratulations to their groupmates. Jonas saw his parents watching him from the place where their own bicycles were waiting. Lily had already been strapped into her seat. He waved, they waved back, smiling. But he noticed that Lily was watching him solemnly, her thumb in her mouth. He rode directly to his dwelling, exchanging only small jokes and unimportant remarks with Asher.
"See you in the morning, recreation director," he called, dismounting by his door as Asher continued on. "Right, see ya," Asher called back.
Once again, there was just a moment when things weren't quite the same, weren't quite as they had always been through the long friendship. Perhaps he had imagined it. Things couldn't change with Asher. The evening meal was quieter than usual. Lily chattered about her plans for volunteer work. She would begin, she said, at the nurturing center, since she was already an expert at feeding Gabriel.
"I know," she added quickly when her father gave her a warning glance. "I won't mention his name. I know I'm not supposed to know his name." "I can't wait for tomorrow to come," she said happily.
Jonas sighed uneasily.
"I can," he muttered.
"You've been greatly honored," his mother said. "Your father and I are very proud."
"It's the most important job in the community," father said.
"But just the other night, you said that the job of making assignments was the most important." Mother nodded. "This is different. It's not a job, really. I never thought, never expected." She paused. "There's only one receiver."
"But the chief elder said that they had made a selection before and that it failed. What was she talking about?"
Both of his parents hesitated. Finally, his father described the previous selection. It was very much as it was today, Jonas, the same suspense as 111 had been passed over when the assignments were given, then the announcement, when they singled out the one. Jonas interrupted.
"What was his name?"
His mother replied, "Her, not his. It was a female. But we are never to speak the name, or to use it again for a new child." Jonas was shocked. A name designated not to be spoken indicated the highest degree of disgrace. "What happened to her?" he asked nervously, but his parents looked blank.
"We don't know," his father said uncomfortably. "We never saw her again."
A silence fell over the room. They looked at each other. Finally, his mother, rising from the table, said, "You've been greatly honored, Jonas. Greatly honored." Alone in his sleeping room, prepared for bed, Jonas opened his folder at last. Some of the other 12s, he had noticed, had been given folders thick with printed pages. He imagined Benjamin, the scientific male in his group, beginning to read pages of rules and instructions with relish. He pictured Fiona smiling her gentle smile as she bent over the lists of duties and methods that she would be required to learn in the days to come. But his own folder was startlingly close to empty. Inside, there was only a single printed sheet. He read it twice. Jonas, receiver of memory. 1. Go immediately at the end of school hours each day to the annex entrance behind the House of the Old and present yourself to the attendant. 2. Go immediately to your dwelling at the conclusion of training hours each day. 3. From this moment, you are exempted from rules governing rudeness. You may ask any question of any citizen, and you will receive answers. 4. Do not discuss your training with any other member of the community, including parents and elders.
5. From this moment, you are prohibited from dream-telling. 6. Except for illness or injury unrelated to your training, do not apply for any medication. 7. You are not permitted to apply for a lease. 8. You may lie. Jonas was stunned. What would happen to his friendships? His mindless hours playing ball or riding his bike along the river? Those had been happy and vital times for him. Were they to be completely taken from him now? The simple logistic instructions, where to go and when, were expected. Every 12 had to be told, of course, where and how and when to report for training. But he was a little dismayed that his schedule left no time, apparently, for recreation. The exemption from rudeness startled him. Reading it again, however, he realized that it didn't compel him to be rude. It simply allowed him the option. He was quite certain he would never take advantage of it. He was so completely, so thoroughly accustomed to courtesy within the community that the thought of asking another citizen an intimate question, of calling someone's attention to an area of awkwardness, was unnerving. The prohibition of dream-telling, he thought, would not be a real problem. He dreamed so rarely that the dream-telling did not come easily to him anyway, and he was glad to be excused from it. He wondered briefly, though, how to deal with it at the morning meal. What if he did dream? Should he simply tell his family unit, as he did so often anyway, that he hadn't? That would be a lie. Still, the final rule said... Well, he wasn't quite ready to think about the final rule on the page. The restriction of medication unnerved him. Medication was always available to citizens, even to children, through their parents. When he had crushed his finger in the door, he had quickly, gasping into the speaker, notified his mother. She had hastily requisitioned relief of pain medication, which had promptly been delivered to his dwelling. Almost instantly, the excruciating pain in his hand had diminished to the throb which was, now, all he could recall of the experience. Rereading rule number 6, he realized that a crushed finger fell into the category of unrelated to training. So if it ever happened again, and he was quite certain it wouldn't, he had been very careful near heavy doors since the accident, he could still receive medication. The pill he took now, each morning, was also unrelated to training, so he would continue to receive the pill. But he remembered uneasily what the chief elder had said about the pain that would come with his training. She had called it indescribable. Jonas swallowed hard, trying without success to imagine what such pain might be like, with no medication at all. But it was beyond his comprehension. He felt no reaction to rule number 7 at all. It had never occurred to him that under any circumstances, ever, he might apply for release. Finally, he steeled himself to read the final rule again. He had been trained, since earliest childhood, since his earliest learning of language, never to lie. It was an integral part of the learning of precise speech. Once, when he had been a 4, he had said, just prior to the midday meal at school, "I'm starving." Immediately, he had been taken aside for a brief private lesson in language precision. He was not starving, it was pointed out. He was hungry. No one in the community was starving, had ever been starving, would ever be starving. To say starving was to speak a lie. An unintentioned lie, of course. But the reason for precision of language was to ensure that unintentional lies were never uttered. Did he understand that? They asked him. And he had. He had never, within his memory, been tempted to lie. Asher did not lie. Lily did not lie. His parents did not lie. No one did. Unless... Now Jonas had a thought that he had never had before. This new thought was frightening. What if others, adults, had, upon becoming 12s, received in their instructions the same terrifying sentence? What if they had all been instructed, "You may lie"? His mind reeled. Now empowered to ask questions of utmost rudeness and promised answers, he could conceivably, though it was almost unimaginable, ask someone, some adult, his father, perhaps, "Do you lie?" But he would have no way of knowing if the answer he received were true.
"I go in here, Jonas," Fiona told him when they reached the front door of the House of the Old after parking their bicycles in the designated area.
"I don't know why I'm nervous," she confessed. "I've been here so often before."
She turned her folder over in her hands.
"Well, everything's different now," Jonas reminded her.
"Even the nameplates on our bikes," Fiona laughed. During the night, the nameplate of each new 12 had been removed by the maintenance crew and replaced with the style that indicated citizen in training.
"I don't want to be late," she said hastily, and started up the steps. "If we finish at the same time, I'll ride home with you."
Jonas nodded, waved to her, and headed around the building toward the annex, a small wing attached to the back. He certainly didn't want to be late for his first day of training either. The annex was very ordinary, its door unremarkable. He reached for the heavy handle, then noticed a buzzer on the wall, so he buzzed instead.
"Yes?"
The voice came through a small speaker above the buzzer.
"It's, Jonas. I'm the new,
"Come in."
A click indicated that the door had been unlatched. The lobby was very small and contained only a desk at which a female attendant sat working on some papers. She looked up when he entered, then, to his surprise, she stood. It was a small thing, the standing, but no one had ever stood automatically to acknowledge Jonas's presence before.
"Welcome, receiver of memory," she said respectfully.
"Oh, please," he replied uncomfortably, "call me Jonas." She smiled, pushed a button, and he heard a click that unlocked the door to her left.
"You may go right on in," she told him.
Then she seemed to notice his discomfort and to realize its origin. No doors in the community were locked, ever. None that Jonas knew of, anyway. The locks are simply to ensure the receiver's privacy because he needs concentration, she explained. It would be difficult if citizens wandered in looking for the Department of Bicycle Repair or something. Jonas laughed, relaxing a little. The woman seemed very friendly, and it was true. In fact, it was a joke throughout the community that the Department of Bicycle Repair, an unimportant little office, was relocated so often that no one ever knew where it was.
"There is nothing dangerous here," she told him.
"But," she added, glancing at the wall clock, "he doesn't like to be kept waiting." Jonas hurried through the door and found himself in a comfortably furnished living area. It was not unlike his own family unit's dwelling. Furniture was standard throughout the community. Practical, sturdy, the function of each piece clearly defined. A bed for sleeping, a table for eating, a desk for studying. All of those things were in this spacious room, though each was slightly different from those in his own dwelling. The fabrics on the upholstered chairs and sofa were slightly thicker and more luxurious. The table legs were not straight like those at home, but slender and curved, with a small carved decoration at the foot. The bed, in an alcove at the far end of the room, was draped with a splendid cloth embroidered over its entire surface with intricate designs. But the most conspicuous difference was the books. In his own dwelling, there were the necessary reference volumes that each household contained, a dictionary, and the thick community volume which contained descriptions of every office, factory, building, and committee, and the Book of Rules, of course. The books in his own dwelling were the only books that Jonas had ever seen. He had never known that other books existed. But this room's walls were completely covered by bookcases, filled, which reached to the ceiling. There must have been hundreds, perhaps thousands of books, their titles embossed in shiny letters. Jonas stared at them. He couldn't imagine what the thousands of pages contained. Could there be rules beyond the rules that governed the community?
Could there be more descriptions of offices and factories and committees? He had only a second to look around because he was aware that the man sitting in a chair beside the table was watching him. Hastily, he moved forward, stood before the man, bowed slightly, and said, "I'm Jonas."
"I know. Welcome, Receiver of Memory."
Jonas recognized the man. He was the elder, who had seemed separate from the others at the ceremony, though he was dressed in the same special clothing that only elders wore. Jonas looked self-consciously into the pale eyes that mirrored his own. "Sir, I apologize for my lack of understanding." He waited. But the man did not give the standard accepting of apology response. After a moment, Jonas went on, "But I think, he corrected, reminding himself that if precision of language were ever to be important, it was certainly important now, in the presence of this man. "That you are the receiver of memory. I was only selected yesterday. I'm not anything at all, not yet." The man looked at him thoughtfully, silently. It was a look that combined interest, curiosity, concern, and perhaps a little sympathy as well. Finally, he spoke.
"Beginning today, this moment, at least to me, you are the receiver. I have been the receiver for a long time, a very, very long time. You can see that, can't you?"
Jonas nodded. The man was wrinkled, and his eyes, though piercing in their unusual lightness, seemed tired. The flesh around them was darkened into shadowed circles. "I can see that you are very old," Jonas responded with respect. The old were always given the highest respect. The man smiled. He touched the sagging flesh on his own face with amusement.
"I am not actually as old as I look," he told Jonas. "This job has aged me. I know I look as if I should be scheduled for release very soon. But actually, I have a good deal of time left. I was pleased, though, when you were selected. It took them a long time."
"The failure of the previous selection was 10 years ago, and my energy is starting to diminish. I need what strength I have remaining for your training. We have hard and painful work to do, you and I. Please, sit down," he said, and gestured toward the nearby chair. Jonas lowered himself onto the soft cushioned seat. The man closed his eyes and continued speaking. "When I became a 12, I was selected, as you were. I was frightened, as I'm sure you are." He opened his eyes for a moment and peered at Jonas, who nodded. The eyes closed again. "I came to this very room to begin my training. It was such a long time ago. The previous receiver seemed just as old to me as I do to you. He was just as tired as I am today." He sat forward suddenly, opening his eyes, and said, "You may ask questions. I have so little experience in describing this process, it is forbidden to talk of it."
"I know, sir. I have read the instructions," Jonas said.
"So I may neglect to make things as clear as I should." The man chuckled. "My job is important and has enormous honor. But that does not mean I am perfect, and when I tried before to train a successor, I failed. Please, ask any questions that will help you."
In his mind, Jonas had questions. 1,000, 1,000,000 questions. As many questions as there were books lining the walls. But he did not ask one, not yet. The man sighed, seeming to put his thoughts in order. Then he spoke again.
"Simply stated," he said, "although it's not really simple at all, my job is to transmit to you all the memories I have within me, memories of the past."
"Sir," Jonas said tentatively, I would be very interested to hear the story of your life and to listen to your memories. I apologize for interrupting, he added quickly. The man waved his hand impatiently. No apologies in this room. We haven't time. Well, Jonas went on, uncomfortably aware that he might be interrupting again. I am really interested. I don't mean that I'm not, but I don't exactly understand why it's so important. I could do some adult job in the community, and in my recreation time, I could come and listen to the stories from your childhood. I'd like that. Actually, he added, I've done that already in the House of the Old. The Old like to tell about their childhoods, and it's always fun to listen. The man shook his head. No, no, he said. I'm not being clear. It's not my past, not my childhood, that I must transmit to you. He leaned back, resting his head against the back of the upholstered chair. It's the memories of the whole world, he said with a sigh. Before you, before me, before the previous receiver, and generations before him. Jonas frowned. The whole world? He asked. I don't understand. Do you mean not just us? Not just the community? Do you mean elsewhere, too? He tried in his mind to grasp the concept. I'm sorry, sir. I don't understand exactly. Maybe I'm not smart enough. I don't know what you mean when you say the whole world or generations before him. I thought there was only us. I thought there was only now. There's much more. There's all that goes beyond, all that is elsewhere, and all that goes back and back and back. I received all of those when I was selected, and here, in this room, all alone, I re-experience them again and again. It is how wisdom comes and how we shape our future. He rested for a moment, breathing deeply. I am so weighted with them, he said. Jonas felt a terrible concern for the man, suddenly. It's as if... The man paused, seeming to search his mind for the right words of description. It's like going downhill through deep snow on a sled, he said finally. At first it's exhilarating, the speed, the sharp, clear air. But then the snow accumulates, builds up on the runners, and you slow. You have to push hard to keep going, and... He shook his head suddenly and peered at Jonas. That meant nothing to you, did it? He asked. Jonas was confused. I didn't understand it, sir. Of course you didn't. You don't know what snow is, do you? Jonas shook his head. Or a sled. Runners. No, sir, Jonas said. Downhill? That term means nothing to you? Nothing, sir. Well, it's a place to start. I've been wondering how to begin. Move to the bed and lie face down. Remove your tunic first. Jonas did so, a little apprehensively. Beneath his bare chest, he felt the soft folds of the magnificent cloth that covered the bed. He watched as the man rose and moved first to the wall where the speaker was. It was the same sort of speaker that occupied a place in every dwelling. But one thing about it was different. This one had a switch, which the man deftly snapped to the end that said, "Off." Jonas almost gasped aloud. To have the power to turn the speaker off. It was an astonishing thing. Then the man moved with surprising quickness to the corner where the bed was. He sat on a chair beside Jonas, who was motionless, waiting for what would happen next. Close your eyes. Relax. This will not be painful. Jonas remembered that he was allowed, that he had even been encouraged to ask questions. What are you going to do, sir? He asked, hoping that his voice didn't betray his nervousness. I am going to transmit the memory of snow, the old man said, and placed his hands on Jonas's bare back. Jonas felt nothing unusual at first. He felt only the light touch of the old man's hands on his back. He tried to relax, to breathe evenly. The room was absolutely silent. And for a moment, Jonas feared that he might disgrace himself now, on the first day of his training, by falling asleep. Then he shivered. He realized that the touch of the hands felt suddenly cold. At the same instant, breathing in, he felt the air change, and his very breath was cold. He licked his lips, and in doing so, his tongue touched the suddenly chilled air. It was very startling, but he was not at all frightened now. He was filled with energy, and he breathed again, feeling the sharp intake of frigid air. Now, too, he could feel cold air swirling around his entire body. He felt it blow against his hands, where they lay at his sides, and over his back. The touch of the man's hands seemed to have disappeared. Now he became aware of an entirely new sensation. Pinpricks? No, because they were soft and without pain. Tiny, cold, feather-like feelings peppered his body and face. He put out his tongue again and caught one of the dots of cold upon it. It disappeared from his awareness instantly, but he caught another and another. The sensation made him smile. One part of his consciousness knew that he was still lying there on the bed in the annex room, yet another, separate part of his being was upright now, in a sitting position, and beneath him he could feel that he was not on the soft, decorated bed covering at all, but rather seated on a flat, hard surface, his hands now held, though at the same time they were still motionless at his sides, a rough, damp rope, and he could see. Though his eyes were closed, he could see a bright, whirling torrent of crystals in the air around him, and he could see them gather on the backs of his hands like cold fur. His breath was visible. Beyond, through the swirl of what he now somehow perceived was the thing the old man had spoken of, snow. He could look out and down a great distance. He was up high someplace. The ground was thick with the furry snow, but he sat slightly above it on a hard, flat object. Sled. He knew abruptly. He was sitting on a thing called sled, and the sled itself seemed to be poised at the top of a long, extended mound that rose from the very land where he was. Even as he thought the word mound, his new consciousness told him, hill. Then the sled, with Jonas himself upon it, began to move through the snowfall, and he understood instantly that now he was going downhill. No voice made an explanation. The experience explained itself to him. His face cut through the frigid air as he began the descent, moving through the substance called snow on the vehicle called sled, which propelled itself on what he now knew without doubt to be runners. Comprehending all of those things as he sped downward, he was free to enjoy the breathless glee that overwhelmed him, the speed, the clear, cold air, the total silence, the feeling of balance, excitement and peace. Then, as the angle of incline lessened, as the mound, the hill, flattened, nearing the bottom, the sled's forward motion slowed. The snow was piled now around it, and he pushed with his body, moving it forward, not wanting the exhilarating ride to end. Finally, the obstruction of the piled snow was too much for the thin runners of the sled, and he came to a stop. He sat there for a moment, panting, holding the rope in his cold hands. Tentatively, he opened his eyes, not his snow hill sled eyes, for they had been open throughout the strange ride. He opened his ordinary eyes and saw that he was still on the bed, that he had not moved at all. The old man, still beside the bed, was watching him,
How do you feel? He asked.
Jonas sat up and tried to answer honestly. Surprised, he said, after a moment.
The old man wiped his forehead with his sleeve. He said.
It was exhausting. But you know, even transmitting that tiny memory to you, I think it lightened me just a little.
Do you mean... You did say I could ask questions.
The man nodded, encouraging his question.
Do you mean that now you don't have the memory of it, of that ride on the sled, anymore?
That's right. A little weight off this old body.
But it was such fun. And now you don't have it anymore. I took it from you.
But the old man laughed.
All I gave you was one ride, on one sled, in one snow, on one hill. I have a whole world of them in my memory. I could give them to you one by one, 1,000 times, and there would still be more.
Are you saying that we could do it again?
Jonas asked.
I'd really like to. I think I could steer by pulling the rope. I didn't try this time because it was so new.
The old man, laughing, shook his head.
Maybe another day for a treat, but there's no time, really, just to play. I only wanted to begin by showing you how it works. Now, he said, turning businesslike, lie back down. I want to...
Jonas did. He was eager for whatever experience would come next. But he had, suddenly, so many questions.
Why don't we have snow and sleds and hills, he asked. And when did we? In the past? Did my parents have sleds when they were young? Did you?
The old man shrugged and gave a short laugh. No, he told Jonas. It's a very distant memory. That's why it was so exhausting. I had to tug it forward from many generations back. It was given to me when I was a new receiver, and the previous receiver had to pull it through a long time period, too.
But what happened to those things? Snow and the rest of it?
Climate control. Snow made growing food difficult, limited the agricultural periods, and unpredictable weather made transportation almost impossible at times. It wasn't a practical thing. So it became obsolete when we went to sameness.
And hills, too, he added. They made conveyance of goods unwieldy. Trucks, buses, slowed them down. So...
He waved his hand as if a gesture had caused hills to disappear.
Sameness, he concluded.
Jonas frowned. I wish we had those things still, just now and then.
The old man smiled.
So do I, he said. But that choice is not ours.
But, sir, Jonas suggested, since you have so much power... The man corrected him.
Honor, he said firmly. I have great honor. So will you. But you will find that that is not the same as power. Lie quietly now. Since we've entered into the topic of climate, let me give you something else. And this time I'm not going to tell you the name of it, because I want to test the receiving. You should be able to perceive the name without being told. I gave away snow and sled and downhill and runners by telling them to you in advance.
Without being instructed, Jonas closed his eyes again. He felt the hands on his back again. He waited. Now it came more quickly, the feelings. This time, the hands didn't become cold, but instead began to feel warm on his body. They moistened a little. The warmth spread, extending across his shoulders, up his neck, onto the side of his face. He could feel it through his clothed parts, too, a pleasant, all-over sensation. And when he licked his lips this time, the air was hot and heavy. He didn't move. There was no sled. His posture didn't change. He was simply alone someplace, out of doors, lying down, and the warmth came from far above. It was not as exciting as the ride through the snowy air, but it was pleasurable and comforting. Suddenly, he perceived the word for it. Sunshine. He perceived that it came from the sky. Then it ended. "Sunshine," he said aloud, opening his eyes.
"Good. You did get the word. Ah, that makes my job easier, not so much explaining."
"And it came from the sky."
"That's right," the old man said. "Just the way it used to."
"Before sameness? Before climate control?" Jonas added. The man laughed.
"You receive well and learn quickly. I'm very pleased with you. That's enough for today, I think. We're off to a good start."
There was a question bothering Jonas. "Sir," he said, "the chief elder told me, she told everyone, and you told me, too, that it would be painful. So I was a little scared, but it didn't hurt at all. I really enjoyed it." He looked quizzically at the old man. The man sighed.
"I started you with memories of pleasure. My previous failure gave me the wisdom to do that." He took a few deep breaths. "Jonas," he said, "it will be painful. But it need not be painful yet."
"I'm brave. I really am." Jonas sat up a little straighter. The old man looked at him for a moment. He smiled.
"I can see that," he said. "Well, since you asked the question, I think I have enough energy for one more transmission. Lie down once more. This will be the last today."
Jonas obeyed cheerfully. He closed his eyes, waiting, and felt the hands again. Then he felt the warmth again, the sunshine again, coming from the sky of this other consciousness that was so new to him. This time, as he lay basking in the wonderful warmth, he felt the passage of time. His real self was aware that it was only a minute or two, but his other memory-receiving self felt hours pass in the sun. His skin began to sting. Restlessly, he moved one arm, bending it, and felt a sharp pain in the crease of his inner arm at the elbow. "Ouch!" he said loudly and shifted on the bed. "Ow!" he said, wincing at the shift, and even moving his mouth to speak made his face hurt. He knew there was a word, but the pain kept him from grasping it. Then it ended. He opened his eyes, wincing with discomfort. "It hurt," he told the man, "and I couldn't get the word for it."
"It was sunburn," the old man told him.
"It hurt a lot," Jonas said, "but I'm glad you gave it to me. It was interesting, and now I understand better what it meant, that there would be pain." The man didn't respond. He sat silently for a second. Finally, he said,
"Get up now. It's time for you to go home."
They both walked to the center of the room. Jonas put his tunic back on. "Goodbye, sir," he said. "Thank you for my first day." The old man nodded to him. He looked drained and a little sad. "Sir," Jonas said shyly.
"Yes? Do you have a question?"
"It's just that I don't know your name. I thought you were the receiver. But you say that now I'm the receiver, so I don't know what to call you." The man had sat back down in a comfortable upholstered chair. He moved his shoulders around as if to ease away an aching sensation. He seemed terribly weary.
"Call me the Giver,"
he told Jonas. "You slept soundly, Jonas?"
his mother asked at the morning meal. "No dreams?" Jonas simply smiled and nodded, not ready to lie, not willing to tell the truth. "I slept very soundly," he said. "I wish this one would," his father said, leaning down from his chair to touch Gabriel's waving fist. The basket was on the floor beside him, in its corner. Beside Gabriel's head, the stuffed hippo sat staring with its blank eyes. "So do I," Mother said, rolling her eyes. "He's so fretful at night." Jonas had not heard the new child during the night because, as always, he had slept soundly. But it was not true that he had no dreams. Again and again as he slept, he had slid down that snow-covered hill. Always, in the dream, it seemed as if there were a destination, a something, he could not grasp what, that lay beyond the place where the thickness of snow brought the sled to a stop.
He was left, upon awakening, with the feeling that he wanted, even somehow needed, to reach the something that waited in the distance. The feeling that it was good, that it was welcoming, that it was significant. But he did not know how to get there. He tried to shed the leftover dream, gathering his schoolwork and preparing for the day. School seemed a little different today. The classes were the same, language and communications, commerce and industry, science and technology, civil procedures and government. But during the breaks for recreation periods and the midday meal, the other new 12s were abuzz with descriptions of their first day of training. All of them talked at once, interrupting each other, hastily making the required apology for interrupting, then forgetting again in the excitement of describing the new experiences. Jonas listened. He was very aware of his own admonition not to discuss his training. But it would have been impossible anyway. There was no way to describe to his friends what he had experienced there in the annex room. How could you describe a sled without describing a hill and snow? And how could you describe a hill and snow to someone who had never felt height or wind or that feathery magical cold? Even trained for years, as they all had been in precision of language, what words could you use which would give another the experience of sunshine? So it was easy for Jonas to be still and to listen. After school hours, he rode again beside Fiona to the house of the old. "I looked for you yesterday," she told him, "so we could ride home together. Your bike was still there, and I waited for a little while, but it was getting late, so I went on home." "I apologize for making you wait," Jonas said. "I accept your apology," she replied, automatically. "I stayed a little longer than I expected," Jonas explained. She pedaled forward, silently, and he knew that she expected him to tell her why. She expected him to describe his first day of training, but to ask would have fallen into the category of rudeness. "You've been doing so many volunteer hours with the old," Jonas said, changing the subject. "There won't be much that you don't already know." "Oh, there's lots to learn," Fiona replied. "There's administrative work and the dietary rules and punishment for disobedience. Did you know that they use a discipline wand on the old, the same as for small children? And there's occupational therapy and recreational activities and medications and..." They reached the building and braked their bikes. "I really think I like it better than school," Fiona confessed. "Me too," Jonas agreed, wheeling his bike into its place. She waited for a second, as if, again, she expected him to go on. Then she looked at her watch, waved, and hurried toward the entrance. Jonas stood for a moment beside his bike, startled. It had happened again. The thing that he thought of now as seeing beyond. This time, it had been Fiona who had undergone that fleeting, indescribable change. As he looked up and toward her going through the door, it happened. She changed. Actually, Jonas thought, trying to recreate it in his mind, it wasn't Fiona in her entirety. It seemed to be just her hair. And just for that flickering instant, he ran through it in his mind. It was clearly beginning to happen more often. First, the apple a few weeks before. The next time had been the faces in the audience at the auditorium just 2 days ago. Now, today, Fiona's hair. Frowning, Jonas walked toward the annex. "I will ask the giver," he decided. The old man looked up, smiling, when Jonas entered the room. He was already seated beside the bed, and he seemed more energetic today, slightly renewed, and glad to see Jonas. "Welcome," he said. "We must get started. You're 1 minute late." "I apologize," Jonas began, and then stopped, flustered, remembering there were to be no apologies. He removed his tunic and went to the bed. "I'm 1 minute late because something happened," he explained, "and I'd like to ask you about it, if you don't mind."
"You may ask me anything."
Jonas tried to sort it out in his mind so that he could explain it clearly. "I think it's what you call seeing beyond," he said.
The giver nodded.
"Describe it," he said.
Jonas told him about the experience with the apple, and then a moment on the stage when he had looked out and seen the same phenomenon in the faces of the crowd. "Then today, just now, outside, it happened with my friend Fiona. She herself didn't change exactly, but something about her changed for a second. Her hair looked different, but not in its shape, not in its length. I can't quite..." Jonas paused, frustrated by his inability to grasp and describe exactly what had occurred. Finally, he simply said, "It changed. I don't know how or why." "That's why I was 1 minute late," he concluded, and looked questioningly at the giver. To his surprise, the old man asked him a question which seemed unrelated to the seeing beyond.
"When I gave you the memory yesterday, the first one, the ride on the sled, did you look around?"
Jonas nodded.
"Yes," he said, "but the stuff, I mean, the snow in the air made it hard to see anything."
"Did you look at the sled?"
Jonas thought back.
"No, I only felt it under me. I dreamed of it last night, too. But I don't remember seeing the sled in my dream either, just feeling it."
The giver seemed to be thinking.
"When I was observing you, before the selection, I perceived that you probably had the capacity, and what you describe confirms that. It happened somewhat differently to me,"
the giver told him.
"When I was just your age, about to become the new receiver, I began to experience it, though it took a different form. With me, it was, well, I won't describe that now. You wouldn't understand it yet. But I think I can guess how it's happening with you. Let me just make a little test to confirm my guess. Lie down."
Jonas lay on the bed again with his hands at his sides. He felt comfortable here now. He closed his eyes and waited for the familiar feel of the giver's hands on his back. But it didn't come. Instead, the giver instructed him,
"Call back the memory of the ride on the sled. Just the beginning of it, where you're at the top of the hill before the slide starts. And this time, look down at the sled."
Jonas was puzzled. He opened his eyes.
"Excuse me," he asked politely, "but don't you have to give me the memory?"
"It's your memory now. It's not mine to experience any longer. I gave it away."
"But how can I call it back?"
"You can remember last year, or the year that you were a 7 or a 5, can't you?"
"Of course."
"It's much the same. Everyone in the community has one generation memories like those. But now you will be able to go back farther. Try. Just concentrate."